people who love them.
All right, this is The Thing About Cars. I am Mickey Desai. We are doing the thing via Zoom again, although, you know, we're not actually sponsored by Zoom.
Perhaps you should be.
Perhaps we should be. So that voice you're hearing belongs to Ray Sheska. Ray is your auto advocate, and I'm glad Ray can join us at the table. How are you doing, Ray?
I am doing well, and it's a pleasure to be with you guys today.
Yeah, I'm glad we could do it. And Ben, are you there?
I am here.
Excellent. And for our listeners, Becca may be joining us, so we hope that she actually comes in late. If she does, then we'll just let her come in late. In the meantime, we're going to get started on our relatively short agenda for this episode. Ben, you think we should start with the moment of Grand Trivia Auto?
Yeah, sure. Let's do it.
Okay. So this one may be too simple. We may have to do two questions today. Grand Trivia Auto, the Eisenhower Tunnel, the highest point on the USA interstate highway system, is near which American city? Right. In the Eisenhower Tunnel, which is the highest point on the USA interstate highway system, is near which American city? Is it Nashville? Is it New York City, Minneapolis, or Denver? So think about that. Before we make any guesses, Ray, we'll answer the question at the end of the show. And if in fact, it's such a short answer, let's just do a second one. We'll ask two questions for this Grand Trivia Auto. The second question I have for Grand Trivia Auto today is, where was the first paved road in the United States located? Was it Los Angeles, New York City, Dallas, or Detroit? And so we'll answer that question at the end of this, at the end of the session as well. The first thing I have on the list today is something that Ben put up there, which is up on our agenda, which is the state of auto sales and delivery. Ben, can you tell us what's on your mind?
Well, basically, with the COVID-19 situation, a lot of people are not buying cars, which is not to say that nobody's buying them, but a lot fewer are. And so inventory is backing up. You know, a lot of dealers are closed too. So it's just kind of the whole industry's kind of got the brakes on, so to speak.
Yeah. No pun intended.
Yeah.
Right. So what's happening? I mean, is the market, are we seeing, Ray, you probably got a bird's eye view to all this. Are prices dropping? Are incentives becoming more available just so people can move product?
Well, I can tell you from some research that I did yesterday, that incentives averaged over $4,000 per car sold for as an expense for the manufacturers during the month of April, which was up significantly from April of 2019. And BMW, for example, their cost for incentives to sell a car averaged over $6,300, which indicates to me that yes, the inventory is backing up, but it's really much more of a regionalized thing than a nationwide thing. Some areas don't seem to be impacted much at all, and other areas are impacted much more severely. But there is a real concern in the industry since sales are off 40% as an industry average just last month over April of 2019.
Oh, yeah. I've been hearing, too, about some, 0% interest offers going on. Of course, I'm also hearing that, we may be at the bottom of this thing right now, that it's probably going to slowly start coming back.
I don't know that we're at the bottom. And the reason I would say that, if you now have 30 million people that are unemployed, you really have 30 million people that are now out of the market and can't buy a car if they wanted to unless they were going to pay cash.
Exactly. I mean, I'm sitting here as a relatively unemployed person, and I would love to be able to take advantage of any of these incentives, but without an income, it's the silliest thing in the world for me to try.
Well, and for whatever reason, banks would think it would be silly on your behalf as well.
Well, and, I am still pretty gainfully employed, and yeah, it all sounds great, but, I've got a car right now that is paid for and meets my needs. So as tempting as it is, I'm staying put.
Yeah.
Well, the manufacturers are hoping that with their incentives that they can change enough minds to make owning a dealership profitable again.
Yeah.
Wait. To make owning a dealership profitable again?
Yeah. You would be surprised as to how many dealerships actually are not profitable.
Yeah, we talked about that briefly before, but in that they actually don't make a ton of their money off the car sales themselves, right?
They do not. And one of the major concerns for so many of the manufacturers is to figure out how to help their dealers become profitable so that they can remain dealers and sell the product that they're trying to sell. And that's part of that's incumbent upon the manufacturer to see to it that it happens.
Right.
Yeah. So it's all these incentives are designed A, to help the manufacturer, but also to help the local franchise dealers, because the manufacturer can't really afford to have them all go out of business.
Exactly. Yeah. Wait, did you see that bit of news that Nissan dealerships actually went to Japan or sent delegates or somebody to go complain to their corporate higher ups that they need to stop producing cars that are not sellable in the American market?
I have read about that. It's not the first time things like that have happened, nor will it be the last. Manufacturers tend not to be as responsive to dealer requests as perhaps they should be.
Right, which kind of shocks me considering how much is really at stake. You'd think that some market research would precede the decision to actually put a car into production.
After 43 years in this business, I was always amazed at how somebody could have said, yeah, that was a good idea. Let's build that model. I remember the
Aztec.
There was what was I think the ZDX was an Acura that was built to compete against the BMW X6, and I remember every time seeing an X6 on the road, I thought, my God, that's a great looking vehicle. And then I remember the reason I thought it was so great looking is because I so rarely saw them. And Acura came out with a competitor to it, and within 3 or 4 years discontinued the model because, well, it wasn't popular. And I could never understand how the head of Acura said, no, that's a good idea. That's really going to drive traffic.
Right.
Yeah. So from the dealer perspective, I oftentimes wondered, who signed off on some of these projects?
Yeah, I think Becca would agree that the Ford Probe, at least in name, she wonders how the Ford Probe ever made it to market.
Yes.
Yeah. And outside of the world of cars, I can't believe someone named it the iPad instead of something else.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's funny.
Yeah. But anyway, so Ben, what happens now? We got all those cars that according to that thing you posted an article in our internal group that said a lot of these a lot of cars are actually not actually making it to physically to land here, right? They're just out at sea.
Right. The article that I put in our group, had one of those clickbaity headlines. It said something like SUVs being parked in the sea. But what it really was that all these big ships coming from Japan carrying big loads of those Nissans that weren't selling to begin with were basically being told to drop anchor about a mile offshore and just sit tight for a while.
Right. Right. Well, if there are any auto dealerships out there that want to hire me to do something, I'd be happy to return the favor by buying a car from one of them.
or just being willing to demo a car for I don't know, a short period of time, maybe a year.
Yeah, exactly. And that is definitely on our agenda when we get back to whatever the new normal looks like. It has been on our agenda to make contact with dealerships to see if we can do exactly that and do test drives and demo cars and work with them to show off what they've got.
And you'll be surprised, but most of them would probably be receptive to that.
Can I get a Lamborghini dealership to be receptive to that?
Probably not, but it's always worth a try.
The worst they can do is say no, right?
Exactly. We already have that. So, yeah.
the question is, would the no come out in record time?
Right. Yeah. Can I hear it with Doppler effect?
My guess is that they start saying no before you finish the question.
Yeah, right.
Can they say it in Italian with the scent of burned gasoline and fine, rich leather on their breath?
I mean, we're joking about Lamborghinis, but if there was an exotic car out there that I would love to demo, I must say it probably would not be a Lamborghini in my case.
Me either.
Yeah.
Well, I know I wouldn't because I if I got in it, I don't know how I'd get out of it.
That's exactly what I'm thinking. I'm like, I'm getting my fat butt in there. I'm never getting out again.
Well, since they've been owned by the VW Audi group, I'd be willing to bet they're a little roomier. German influence, you know, the Germans make roomy cars.
Well, yeah. I can tell you, having gotten into one of the R8s that we had at an Audi dealership that I used to manage, that it took three people to help pull me out of it.
Oh, well, if that was the case, I would recommend that you not even try a BMW i8.
Oh, yeah. Ronnie has said that even athletic people have a hard time getting out of that car.
Yeah, it's got not only an awkwardly, you know, positioned seat and, you know, very low slung and all that, but it also has a very, very high door sill that intrudes into the opening quite a bit.
Yeah. And Ray doesn't know Ronnie, has not met Ronnie, but Ronnie is a BMW master mechanic. I think that's right. Isn't that, Ben?
I believe so, yeah, or factory trained, whatever.
Trained something or other, and he's got quite a bit to say about every BMW model that's ever been made, and he did not say very flattering things about the i8 at all.
Yeah, we could go on about that, but yeah. Let's not. Although, if you want to see something hilarious as far as the ergonomics of getting in and out, watch me try to get in or out of a Lotus Elise. for the listeners who, you know, haven't seen me, I'm about 6'4", 275, big in the hips, and this car has a door that's, you know, about the size of a TV screen or so, not even a big screen at that. It's got a really wide door sill. There's not a lot of stuff. You can't, you know, hoist yourself on the roof because you'll collapse it. Because it'll, you know, yeah, it's really something. There's even people who are used to it, who are smaller than me, will tell you that it takes practice to get into the car without hooking your knees on the wheel.
That's too funny.
And getting out is even more hilarious, because the only thing I can do if the top is on is to basically lean out, walk my hands on the pavement until my knees can drop out.
Right, exactly. Do this modified push-up to get out of the car.
Right.
Yeah.
There's something wrong with a design like that.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's it. They were thinking, if I'm remembering correctly, it was not about the driver. That car was not produced around a driver. It was produced to be sort of a go-kart, a nicely appointed go-kart.
Yeah, they took minimalism a bit far with it. I mean, once I'm inside, there's enough headroom, there's enough leg room, although my hips are a bit wide for the seat bolsters.
Yeah.
My knees touch the, or my thighs touch the steering wheel, and there's no column adjust. So, I mean, I could in theory drive it, but it wouldn't be that comfy.
Right.
Which is a shame, because I've ridden in them and they're a blast on the road.
A lot of the best cars to drive are not the most comfortable cars to drive.
Oh no, I used to have an Esprit, so I can vouch for that.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely.
So let's move on with the agenda. I have an item on my list called, let's talk about this guy who buried a car, or no, he didn't bury the car, but this British fellow was just fooling around in his backyard doing some gardening when he discovered a car, literally an entire car buried in his backyard. Turns out he's unearthed what is believed to be a Ford Popular. I think that was the name of the car, Ford Popular from the 1950s. And they did a little bit of research, and initially he was befuddled. He's like, it's not every day you find an entire car literally buried in the middle of your garden. So they did some work. The entire car was there, you know, identification numbers, license plate, engine, the whole thing is in the ground. And they were able to find the old family.
Oh,
wow. Turns out they were even able to find the guy who did the burying of the car. And apparently he's well into his 90s now, but the story goes that the car broke down and it would have cost him too much to fix it. And the price of steel at the time was so low that it would have cost him money to scrap it. And so he just buried the whole thing in his backyard. And the whole story is just that simple.
Wow.
Yeah. But I'm taking a look at what this car would look like in its, you know, clean condition. And I'm like, man, it's too bad that they didn't at least leave it, you know, so that someone could restore it. But yeah,
that's quite the story, and it would have been really something if a new one had grown.
Wow! Yeah,
that's a market changing. And
well, I can one up you on that. I just did a little web search. I just searched on car buried in yard, and I found a headline from 2012 where a A 1974 Ferrari Dino 246 GTS was buried in a yard in Los Angeles.
That thing is the stuff of legends.
It was buried in 1978, apparently.
Yeah, and then there was huge mysteries after they dug it up as to how exactly the car got in there.
Right.
In fact, these two guys on Motor Trend, they have their autobiography or whatever it's called. Their show is literally about, you know, mysterious cars or car lore or car culture. And they have this huge sensationalistic program where they give you all these clickbait cliffhangers in between commercial breaks.
Oh, yeah.
So I shouldn't speak too badly of them because I would love to work for Motor Trend someday. But
oh, yeah.
but I'm like, really? You're going to put that on TV in that way? And it's like this is worse than the news, right? It's like head found in your front yard, details at 11, you know? It's just like and it was just 10 times worse than that. But anyway, the story is the long story made very, very short is that the car was stolen.
Oh, wow.
And the people who lost the car could never recover it. Why? Because the people who stole it buried it almost immediately.
Yeah.
And they buried it because apparently they couldn't find a safe way to fence it without being, you know, caught. And because it was a, you know, it was a Ferrari. It was a very nice, expensive car. And,
sure, yeah.
And so they thought the safest thing to do to maintain their freedom was simply to bury it. So they literally buried it underneath the driveway where they had thrown a tarp over it. And however many years later, it surfaced and it became the stuff of mystery. It's like, how did this Ferrari come to be there? And to their credit, those autobiography guys did a lot of really good homework. I have to give them credit for that. They did the research and then of course they produced it quite sensationalistically on their show. But yeah, the whole thing is the stuff of legends apparently.
And then you've got the cars that were, you know, buried completely on the up and up, you know, with not secretly, you know, very knowledgeably done, you know, they were put underground for, you know, legitimate reasons. And of course, everybody's probably scratching their heads and going, why? Yeah. Well, one I can think of right here in Gwinnett County, there is a church here that has a 52 Dodge under the driveway on its property. And the reason for that was that the property goes downhill from the road, and, you know, somebody used to live in a trailer on that property, and they had old junk cars and appliances, you know, scattered throughout the land. And when it was all being cleared and developed for the church, the driveway was going to have to be brought to a less steep grade. And they said, well, we can buy a bunch of fill dirt, or we can take that old junk car over there and use it for fill. And that's what they did. And it's, you know, it's still holding up. It was already collapsed enough, or, you know, in such shape that it wasn't going to collapse once buried. So yeah, it's still working.
That's too funny.
There's another one in Oklahoma. I can't remember if it was Tulsa or Oklahoma City, someplace in Oklahoma, where in 1958, they had a new city hall. And so they did or something like that. They have some big fancy celebration. They decided they're going to bury a time capsule out front. And they, you know, being the late 50s, the space age was on, and they're saying, yeah, what's life going to be like in 50 years? Are we going to have flying cars? Are we going to be living on the moon and all that, you know, 50s futuristic jazz? So they buried a brand new 1958 Plymouth Belvedere.
Wow.
In a concrete vault. And they said, well, we might be, you know, driving electric or nuclear cars then, so we better bury some gasoline with it too. I'm not making this up. But they put some drums of gasoline down there with it and some other supplies and things, and they closed the thing up. And in 2008, the time capsule was opened. They dug it up and pulled the roof off, and it was a mess. Because nobody thought to seal this thing against moisture.
Ooh.
So the car wasn't completely gone. I mean, it was still in the shape of a car, but it didn't look very good. There was still a lot of paint on it. But, you know, I don't think this car was ever going to drive again. And, of course, gasoline usually has a shelf life of about 2 months.
I was going to say, did they stabilize it?
I don't think so. Even the stabilizing products you can get today probably wouldn't be good for 50 years.
I imagine not. Yeah. So that Dino that you mentioned, Ben, someone actually restored it.
Oh, awesome.
And I think it's in someone's collection today.
Nice.
Yeah.
Now, did the people it was stolen from, did they ever collect?
I think that the case was closed for them. I think there must have been some sort of insurance thing that happened for them, and that's they washed their hands of the whole affair at that point.
I would think so. I know a guy, a friend of mine, whose father bought a Rolls Royce back in the 1960s. He'd always wanted one, and you know, once he started working as a doctor and making the big bucks, he bought one. It wasn't new, but he bought this car, and it was stolen from him 2 months later. Cops never found it. Insurance paid him off, you know, so it was out of his hands. And then about 5 years ago, the car turned up.
Wow.
How it got registered and through the system for so many years without ever coming up, I don't know, but it was found. It was in a body shop getting painted in the same state he lived in, you know, 40 some years later. Because the insurance had paid him for it, he had to buy it back, but he did. And it came back with nicer paint than when he last saw it.
Yeah, very nice.
Yeah. It was done in like a 1960s Jaguar gunmetal gray, I think is what the shop had put on it.
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine that? At least they gave him first shot at it, because at that point I would think the insurance company could sell it to whomever they wanted.
Oh, absolutely. They could.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I wish I had tales like that to tell from the car business, but unfortunately I don't.
That's okay.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen a lot of strange things, but that's not one of them. I've seen cars disappear. that I've seen. I've seen customers come in and say they'd like to test drive a car and go show it to their wife and then never see the customer or the car again. I've seen that.
That would be called theft, if I'm not mistaken.
In most states, Grand Theft Auto. Yes, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've got a 10-minute warning happening here on Zoom, so let's cover our last topic, and then we'll answer the trivia questions. And we may have done this before. Ben, you may remember this, but I'm looking at an article written by Gas Buddy. It's on their Gas Buddy blog. The app, of course, is what I'm referring to, Gas Buddy.
Yeah.
And this was written in March of 2019. They compiled data from their drives feature in the Gas Buddy app, examining the top 30 metropolitan areas by population, noting the frequency of an aggressive event while driving, whether it be speeding, hard braking, or accelerating. What do you suppose are the top 10 cities with the most aggressive drivers, according to their list?
Ooh. I'm going to say the Washington, D.C. area is one of them.
Yeah, it certainly seems like it would be.
I've driven it. It should be.
Yeah. Oh, my God. The worst traffic jam of my life I've ever been in was coming out of D.C.
Yeah.
It took me 5.5 hours to do what should have taken me 20 minutes to do.
Well, that sounds like everything in Washington.
Right, not just the traffic.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Ben, what do you think?
Oh, well, my first guess is that there's a somewhat but not perfect correlation with population centers.
Yeah, I don't know if this was a per capita list or what, but I'll just go ahead and read it since we're a little bit short on time. And it says, you know, that the top of the list, of course, is nobody surprised, Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And so the top 10 in decreasing order, in fact, I'll go bottom up. Let's start with number 10 and work up to Los Angeles. Number 10, according to this study, is Las Vegas. And then followed by Austin, Texas. Detroit comes in before that. Orlando tops Detroit. Then San Diego, San Francisco. Atlanta is number 4 on the list. Sacramento, California is number 3. Philadelphia, according to these people, is number 2. And then Los Angeles is the city with the most aggressive drivers.
Wow.
So it says Los Angeles consistently tops the list of having some of the most expensive gas prices in the nation, which I'm not sure that applies anymore. But yeah, they do a study. Apparently Gas Buddy does some good data collection, and they actually list a methodology here. It says additional findings include, and you may find this interesting, frustrating Fridays. Motorists at the time of this article, motorists were 1.2 times more likely to encounter aggressive driving on Friday than on a Wednesday.
I believe it.
Yeah. The most aggressive day on the road is Friday, with 14% more aggressive driving events occurring compared to the average across the United States. The least aggressive day is on Wednesday. I guess people are resigning themselves to their fate on Wednesday and hoping to get the hell out of Dodge on Friday.
Yes.
Yeah.
It says here, wearing out the brakes all week. It says the most frequent aggressive driving habit on weekdays is hard braking, followed by rapid acceleration and speeding. On weekends, the most frequent aggressive driving habit continues to be hard braking, followed by speeding and rapid acceleration. I mean, I don't know. That doesn't seem that surprising to me.
No, not at all.
No.
And most of that doesn't matter anymore today because, well, nobody's driving.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a tank of gas that's I'm getting 6 weeks to the gallon there.
Yeah.
Nice.
It's crazy.
It is crazy. It says, while cities like Los Angeles and Philadelphia take the top spots in regard to hard braking and accelerating, it's San Diego, Orlando, and Detroit taking the top three spots for cities with the most speeding incidents. And my comment there is, well, it's kind of hard to speed when you don't have an open road.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Absolutely. But interesting data set. I thought that was interesting to talk about for a bit. So I'm getting text messages from Becca and from Ronnie. So Ronnie apparently has been trying to sell a BMW since 11 o'clock, and the guy who's there looking at the car just can't make up his mind to do it.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I'm like, you gotta hate when that happens.
I'm like, he's been at your house for 2 hours and he just won't do it? Tell him to come back when he's got a clue.
Yeah.
You know? And then Becca's been having a hard morning, and hopefully she's feeling better later on. I'll check in with her later. She's got a headache. So if anybody can send a good vibe to Becca, that'd be great. Let's wrap up the episode with the Grand Trivia Auto question, shall we?
Sure, yeah.
Good to be.
How much time we got? 3 minutes, just in time. All right. So the Eisenhower Tunnel, which is the highest point on the USA interstate highway system, is near which American city? Is it Denver, Minneapolis, New York City, or Nashville? What do you guys think?
My guess would be Nashville.
I'm going to say Denver.
Why do you say Nashville, Ray?
It's in the Blue Mountains.
Yeah.
Blue Ridge Mountains.
Yep. That would have been my guess too. Ben, why are you picking Denver?
Because I've been in this tunnel.
Ah.
I know where it is.
So Ben knows where it is. And in fact, the answer is the Eisenhower Memorial Tunnel is about 60 miles west of Denver on Interstate 70. It is the highest vehicular tunnel in the world at an elevation of 11,013 feet. And the eastern portal, it's at 11,013 feet on its eastern portal and 11,158 feet at the western portal. So it actually goes up going west.
Wow.
Yeah.
To come back to Nashville, though, I mean, the city itself is in a relatively flat place, but one thing that I've done a lot in my business travels lately, going through Tennessee, the interstate between Chattanooga and Nashville, there's a mountain a little bit north of Chattanooga along the road there that's always fun. I believe I-24 goes through there. And it splits where the northbound side is on one side of the mountain and the southbound side is on the other side, for part of it anyway. And it's one of the twistiest parts of the interstate system I've been on. There aren't a whole lot of places on the interstates that are exciting, but I always have fun driving over that mountain.
It's fun stuff. Yeah. So less than 60 seconds to go. I'm going to try to rush the second question in. Where was the first paved road in the United States located? Was it Los Angeles, New York City, Dallas, or Detroit?
I'll go with Detroit.
Ben?
I haven't a clue, so I'm going to say Dallas just for the hell of it.
It's actually Woodward Avenue made history when it became the first paved road. Specifically, a mile of Woodward from 6 Mile Road to 7 Mile Road in Detroit was converted to a concrete highway in 1909.
Ah.
So that is it. We've got less than a minute to go, and I'm going to say to our audience, thank you for listening to The Thing About Cars. We love your feedback on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and wherever else you find us. Please, we need your questions and your comments via our website, which is thethingaboutcars.com, or our Facebook page. Just search for The Thing About Cars, and you should find us there. In the meantime, thank you, Ray. Thank you for Ben. And thank you for, the listener for joining us for this episode. We'll see you again with another one in about a week.
Terrific. Thank you.
Later on.